When a woman thinks her feelings are all that count, she doesn't care who suffers.
There's always somebody out there that wants to hurt someone.
You like that?
A rowdy teen turns into a callous thug.
There is no other way to describe this but as a hate crime.
A mother doesn't care about other people's children.
She distracted him and then hit him over the head with a hammer.
And a young woman wants to be her friend, literally.
It was an attempt to turn fantasy into reality.
These deadly women killed people who did them no harm. They are heartless souls. Teenagers love to connect.
To them, everything was a game.
Social networking means sharing everything.
They were almost reveling in what they were doing.
Good and bad.
It didn't seem to register that actually they were killing someone.
London, 2008. There's trouble brewing in a middle-class suburb of England's capital city.
Oh, God, stop!
Ruby Thomas is only 16, but is living like an adult.
She had ectopic pregnancy. She was a binge drinker, and it wasn't a great way to start your teenage years.
Ruby, you need to turn that music down.
Her single mom tries to keep Ruby on the straight and narrow.
Ruby's mother was, by all accounts, a hardworking and caring mother.
Have you been drinking?
No.
Her mom saved and scrimped in order to get her going to a privately funded school. I think it was something like £16,000 a year.
You, young lady, are absolutely unbelievable.
Close the door.
Ruby is smart and excels in class.
Ruby appeared to be a bright student. She was good at maths and certain other subjects.
But good grades don't make up for her out-of-class behavior.
She was someone that broke the rules. She was wearing makeup at this school where that was against the policy. She reveled in having a reputation for being a hellraiser.
Ruby wants to be the tough girl.
She was very nasty to a lot of the other girls and would call some of them ugly and make them cry.
I think she hated anyone that was perceived to be different. She clearly felt that she could just belittle them, bully them, intimidate them.
Ruby was always angry, always looking for a fight. She seemed to try to get herself kicked out. And eventually she was expelled from that school.
Ruby's belligerent behavior worsens.
What are you looking at, young fat? You want a taste?
By the age of 15, Ruby had a criminal record for drunken and loutish behavior.
But you'd love a little taste.
Oi, sit down.
Bob off.
Drinking transforms Ruby, the loudmouth, into something more sinister.
Come on, little squeak.
Sit down or get out.
And when she'd consumed alcohol, she became incredibly violent. There was a lot of anger inside her.
Get out!
And it would all come out and explode when she began drinking alcohol.
You know what? Get back, Grandpa.
She was very aggressive. If you were seeing trouble, she probably would have started it, particularly when she was drunk.
Back, Grandpa, huh?
In 2007, Ruby is convicted of the vicious assault on a bus driver. Being a violent drunk is following in her father's footsteps. 6 years earlier, 11-year-old Ruby idolizes her father.
Daddy's home.
Until the day he doesn't come home.
When Ruby was only 11, her father went to prison for killing a man. He stabbed a taxi cab driver 28 times.
Learning her father is a killer changes everything for Ruby.
I think the moment that her dad went to prison, you could see that family life was just falling apart.
Seeing her father incarcerated for murder might have told her, this is your lot as well. You are his daughter. It was like she couldn't wait to be just like her father.
At an age when most teenagers are thinking about their future, Ruby is caught in her past. With her anger and alcoholism growing, she is a ticking time bomb.
Oh, hello, girls.
All these traumas and problems that were occurring to Ruby culminated in one appalling incident.
They disgust me.
Somewhere, sometime, someone will pay.
Look at him.
She was looking for trouble. She wanted to hurt someone.
Have it.
A loving mother and a private school education can't tame English teenager Ruby Thomas.
Get back, Grandpa.
After her father is convicted of murder, Ruby's life spirals out of control.
Inside, she found it very hard, I think, to deal with the fact that her father wasn't around. But in terms of her exterior, she was someone that just didn't give a damn, really, in terms of what other people thought about her.
Trafalgar Square, a landmark meeting place for Londoners and tourists. On September 25th, 2009, Ruby is there with two friends, 18-year-old Joel Alexander and 17-year-old Rachel Burke.
They formed what one could really describe as a mini gang.
Your head.
Ruby starts harassing passers-by for sport.
No! Hello, farm animal!
I don't know whether she was proving something to her friends or proving something to herself.
You wear it on your head.
Nevertheless, that night, someone was going to get hurt really bad.
Yes!
Also out on the town is 62-year-old Ian Bonham.
I wouldn't have lost it. Don't be silly. Put me in the corns.
Ian was gay, and openly so. Had been for some years. Because of his age, he spent a lot of time hiding his homosexuality, but it's a reflection of the way society has changed in recent years that he felt confident enough to come out.
Ian is a strong advocate for equal rights.
If he saw what he deemed to be an injustice, he would walk in and try and solve the problem. He was well known for this. He wasn't afraid to speak his mind, and he wasn't afraid to challenge people.
So where are we going to go on holiday?
How about Bang?
But Ian's gay pride isn't welcome tonight. Ian and his friend end up in Trafalgar Square.
Minding their own business, when suddenly Ruby shouts expletives at them after she sees them holding hands.
Faggots!
Ian is outraged by Ruby's homophobic comments and challenges her, quite rightly, to find out why she feels so much anger towards him.
Oh, he didn't like that. Huh?
Oh, you not happy?
Ian had no idea who he was dealing with. Ruby was ready to explode, ready to let it go. And Ian, in her mind, provided her with that opportunity. He stood up to her. So he would have to pay.
With a girlfriend, huh?
Vicious verbal altercation followed between Ruby and Ian. And when that ended, Ruby then slashed out at him with her handbag.
Her friend quickly joins in.
Punch which Joel Alexander threw at Ian just knocked him to the ground, and blood started pouring out of his head.
Ian is immediately unconscious. But the teens don't walk away. They sink the boot into their defenseless victim.
They were still punching and kicking his body, so much so that his head was swinging from side to side. It seemed like a scene from a horror film, really. They were almost reveling in what they were doing.
Both girls were laughing and smiling and shouting obscenities, like a scene out of Clockwork Orange.
Somebody help!
They are fatal blows. If the gang has any remorse, they don't show it.
The girls were later spotted giggling and dancing as they entered a nearby elevator as if they didn't have a care in the world.
To them, everything was a game. Attacking someone, causing them to have fatal injuries, it was just something that they would do, and they didn't even seem to register how far they had gone.
Their brazen attack in a landmark tourist attraction means there are witnesses. To make the police's job even easier, the teens brag on social media.
One of their friends actually went to the police to tell them about what they had done.
Despite their pleas of innocence, the evidence against them is overwhelming. In January 2011, Rachel Burke, guilty of assault, sentenced to 2 years. Joel Alexander, who threw the punch, guilty of manslaughter, and sentenced to 6 years. Ringleader, Ruby Thomas, guilty of manslaughter, and sentenced to 7 years. Her charge officially labeled a hate crime.
There is no other way to describe this but as a hate crime. These two men were attacked viciously because they were gay.
But homophobia isn't Ruby's real problem. Anger and alcohol are, just like her daddy.
Make no mistake about it, Ruby is a violent psychopath. Ian had no idea he was dealing with a ticking time bomb. This is really a cautionary tale. You never know what's going on in the head and the heart of a stranger on the corner. Be cautious.
On December 2nd, 1978, in a quiet community in Santa Barbara, something happens that strikes fear into every parent's heart. A missing child.
It was on a Saturday, which was typically a busy day for us at the market.
Yolanda Magana remembers the day well. As a 12-year-old in her family's grocery store,
my mom wanted to go shopping because Christmas was around the corner. My dad said, sure, you can go ahead and leave. I'll take over the register. You know, you taking the kids with you? And she said, sure, I'll take the kids with me.
Javier, is he going with you?
Oh, yeah. Go get your brother.
But when they are leaving, Yolanda can't find her 7-year-old brother, Javier.
We weren't sure if my dad didn't hear that we said he wasn't with us or if we just left.
Both parents think the little boy is with the other. He's not. He's left alone to play. When Yolanda and her mother return, they discover he's missing.
I remember going out to look for him. And I went to check with his playmate. And he had told me, you know, that he hadn't seen him ever since he had gone across the way into Julia's apartment.
Javier! Ayúdeme con algo, por favor.
I'll be back in a minute.
Javier was last seen walking into the apartment of local babysitter, 22-year-old Julia Diaz. A new but trusted member of the community.
Being we were familiar with this apartment, I didn't hesitate to knock on the door and ask, you know, if my brother was there.
Hi, Julia. Have you seen Javier?
No.
Can I look around? He likes to hide.
Javier isn't there. But Yolanda recalls something strange about Julia's behavior.
She's just gotten out of the shower, and she's looking at me through the bathroom mirror. Her hair is up in a towel.
I can't find him anywhere. My mom is just so worried about him.
I tell him to go home if I see.
I turned around to walk away, and she walked up behind me and put her hand on me, saying, you know, well, wait a minute, don't leave.
Don't leave.
Yolanda is much closer to her brother than she thinks. Julia, a Mexican immigrant, has a troubled and violent past.
She, like many other immigrants that come to California, was trying to make money and send money home and support her family. She had a child who was left back in Mexico with her mother to raise, which is not terribly uncommon.
Making money is not easy. Her first job as a hotel chambermaid doesn't last.
What is taking you so long?
No inglés.
You're smoking. You... Don't you dare push me!
She's fired for a vicious temper.
You're fired.
And she had a physical altercation with a coworker, pulled some scissors out.
In Santa Barbara, she lands some work babysitting.
Hola, everything okay?
Yes, okay.
Would you be able to babysit my children?
The migrant community reaches out and welcomes her. But they have no idea who they are dealing with.
I'll only be a couple of hours. It's okay?
Her young life was very spotty. She was in some trouble. She had some mental health issues. She was committed somewhere around the age of 14 or 15 years old.
No one suspects Julia is anything but a quiet neighbor. Someone else to look out for the kids.
Next door to the market, there was a duplex, and she lived in the rear apartment of the duplex. We were the only kids in the neighborhood besides another family, so there was four of us that would run around together. And the neighbors always kept an eye on us.
When Julia watches the children, she's not looking out for them. She's plotting. 5 days before Javier goes missing, Julia is behind an unthinkable act.
This was a very cowardly, terrible act that she performed.
While babysitting a neighborhood girl, instead of caring for her, Julia brutally attacks the child.
She hit her with some kind of an object, something heavy. Hit her pretty hard, whereby she was stunned and was bleeding. And then, after the attack...
What happened?
She ran out saying there's been an attack, called the police.
The little girl did not see who hit her.
In the following days, Julia pretends to find letters that threaten the girl's family.
Julia Diaz, in her mind at the time, thought that she could extort money from the family since they were now in a state of terror around the attack.
They said something like, if you don't give me the money, worse things will happen.
Julia wants big money. The extortion notes ask for $10,000.
Pretty much all Julia has ever known is violence with other humans. Julia never learned to live peacefully with other people, picking fights and stealing. That's how she survived.
The family isn't rich and don't have anything close to $10,000. After 5 days without a payment, Julia decides to show she's serious. This time, 7-year-old Javier is in her sights.
I don't know exactly what she said to catch his attention and to have him go into the apartment, but it had to be something he was familiar with if he went so willingly.
Javier walks into a trap. Santa Barbara, 1978. 22-year-old babysitter Julia Diaz is trying to extort money from families by threatening their children. She attacks a girl 5 days earlier, but no one has paid up. Now she raises the stakes. Julia sets her sights on another family and lures 7-year-old Javier Angel into her home.
It is suspected that once the little boy was missing, she was going to follow up with another note saying, I told you I wanted money, you didn't give it to me. Now your child is missing. Give me the money and I'll return him.
Javier is not going home.
She invited him in and then hit him over the head with a hammer.
After that, she strangled him with some form of rope or twine or something.
She put a garbage bag over him, tied it, and put another garbage bag over him. He wasn't dead when he was put in the bags.
Javier survives the blow and the strangling, but can't survive suffocation.
He would have died within a matter of a minute, maybe, without air, without oxygen. A child that young would just, you know, he wouldn't have lasted very long.
Julia Diaz is a violent, evil person. Anyone that would do something against a child is not a good person.
When Javier's sister Yolanda comes looking for him that afternoon, she has no idea. She's talking to her brother's killer.
What possibly could my brother have ever done to have deserved something like that? Nobody deserves that.
Can't find him anywhere.
While the search for Javier is underway, the killer makes an eerie appearance at the family store.
Julia went into the market and asked her victim's parents if they could sell her something to wash the blood out of her clothes.
Hello?
I mean, she was like a psychopath. She had no feeling. Kill a child and ask her parents, you know, how do you get blood from the child off my pants? I mean, jeez.
Julia?
She was either being stupid or sadistic.
Do you have good cleaner?
Or maybe something in between.
Or blood on clothes?
Whatever Julia is thinking, she has no time for her next move. Police already have her in their sights. Sadly, they are too late for Javier.
Well, the unfortunate thing about this case is she was suspected as the person who had sent the notes, and the police were going to arrest her in the early afternoon before the homicide. Unfortunately, they were called out on a stakeout. Had they not been on the stakeout, they would have taken her in earlier and this homicide wouldn't have occurred.
So, who wrote the letters?
Once in custody.
They didn't know who wrote it.
Julia inadvertently gives herself away.
Was it you, Julie?
No!
And you had nothing to do with Javier's death?
No, I did not hit that boy.
She said, I never hit that boy.
And how do you know the boy got hit?
Who said it?
Now, a person not knowing anything about what happened wouldn't say, you know, I didn't hit the boy.
I never said that.
It's like saying I didn't stab the person. How would you know he was stabbed?
Javier is soon found under Julia's bed. His little body still warm.
Feeling his warm body and knowing that he was likely still alive when he was stuffed in those bags. He had been found with pieces of her hair in his hands, which would suggest that he did try to ward her off, fight her off, and was defensive in the attack.
Yolanda remembers the day she learns the horrible truth.
As I walked down the main aisle of the market, I could hear my mom and dad, but I could hear them like wailing and crying. I looked at everyone and I said, you know, where's my brother at? And I go, it seems like, you know, he's been found. And no one would say anything.
In July 1979, Julia Diaz is convicted of first-degree murder. She is sentenced to life in prison. In 2011, Julia is denied parole for another 15 years.
I will do everything I can to keep her in prison until the day she dies. And I will make sure this gets taken care of until the day I die. How could someone that's a mother herself have done something to a little boy that was almost the same age as hers? No one's ever been able to figure her out.
Julia's intentions remain a mystery, but money seems to be her primary motive.
Maybe she felt she deserved better than she had in life, and maybe monetarily she could get that, but why take it out on two children?
The most important thing in Julia's life is Julia. She feels nothing for what she did to that little boy. I don't think any children were safe when Julia was around. End of story.
Some girls grow up fantasizing about looking and acting like someone else.
She was slim, she was beautiful, she was a dancer.
But what if it becomes a reality? In Melbourne, Australia, during the 1990s, 19-year-old Caroline Reed Robertson is suffering from low self-esteem. Although teenage angst isn't uncommon, for Caroline, it proves a huge burden.
She had been sad and lonely and miserable most of her life.
What are you looking at those for?
At times, she wishes she had never been born.
Why didn't you just abort me? What is wrong with you?
It seems that she really hated herself, everything about herself.
She described herself as being ugly and fat and a misfit, and hated and lonely and no friends.
Deeply unhappy, Caroline fills diaries with self-loathing.
It's not unusual for teenage girls to doodle, to make lists about themselves, what they want in life. But they usually grow out of it by the time they're 14, 15. That didn't happen for Carolyn. She was making lists when she was 20. Everything with Carolyn went to the extreme.
But life takes a fresh turn when the Barber family moves in next door. Three daughters, all with artistic pursuits. Caroline gets to babysit the talented children.
Just call me on this number if you need anything, okay?
Yeah, sure, thanks.
All right, I'll be back at 5, okay? Okay.
Bye. Bye.
Bye, Mom.
To an outsider like Caroline, this loving, creative, beautiful family was, to all intents and purposes, the perfect family.
Did you want to give it a go?
Come on.
All right.
Caroline takes a special interest in 13-year-old promising ballet dancer, Rachel.
She became, for some strange reason, obsessed with Rachel.
That's it. That's really good. So now you pop your left one just over there. Good.
Can you be my best friend?
Sure. Yeah. Okay,
all right. As if they were best friends, but they weren't. She was simply Rachel's babysitter.
We'll do it another time, all right?
In Caroline's eyes, Rachel is perfection.
In 1997, Caroline asked to take some photographs of Rachel, allegedly for a school project that she was doing.
It wasn't a school assignment. It was about Caroline feeding her obsession about Rachel. She was quite mesmerized by her and really had her up on a pedestal. Rachel could do nothing wrong and be nothing wrong.
In contrast, Caroline's old friends have always teased her.
I heard you wanted to be a singer or a dancer or something.
Oh. Maybe you can sing for us.
About her desire to be a dancer like Rachel.
She seemed to have been the object of amusement of her friends, so that when she would make a suggestion, I want to be an actress or a dancer or something, that would be met with laughter and derision, which made her even more unhappy and lonely.
Caroline wants to leave her old world and live in a new one. Rachel's world.
She was, in a nutshell, everything that Caroline wished that she was herself.
She certainly became fixated on Rachel, and at some point of time, interest became something more than that. Most of her waking hours were devoted to thinking about Rachel.
For 2 years, Caroline's fixation grows.
One thing that Caroline did was apply for Rachel's birth certificate, a thing that's usually done if you plan to assume someone's identity.
She doesn't just want to be like Rachel. Caroline plans to be Rachel.
She really wanted to morph into Rachel. She wanted a do-over.
Melbourne, Australia, 1999. 21-year-old Caroline Reed Robertson is obsessed with a young friend. 15-year-old Rachel Barber.
Caroline saw in Rachel things that she didn't have herself and wanted. Some would call that a fixation. I call it jealousy.
Caroline wants a new life. Rachel's. In her mind, taking it is the only way to achieve her goals.
It was an attempt to turn fantasy into reality.
Her plan is simple. As a trusted family friend, Caroline has no trouble coercing the teenager into a trap.
Rachel, it's Caroline.
Hi, Caroline.
The ruse was going to be used that she had obtained some job for her, which was going to pay her a fair bit of money, which for a young girl of 15 was very attractive.
The pay is really good.
Really? Yeah, that sounds great.
Caroline asks her to keep it a secret from her parents.
Come to my place tomorrow night.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll come off to dance.
And invites Rachel to her apartment.
Okay, thanks.
To meet her new employer.
Thank you, bye.
I've got no doubt at all that Rachel had no idea what was coming.
On March 1st, the stage is set. At school, Rachel is excited.
Rachel was boasting to a couple of her friends at dance class.
You know those shoes I've been looking at?
Yeah, the $100 ones.
Are you going to be able to afford them?
How?
That she had scored some kind of opportunity to make a lot of money.
What kind of job?
I can't talk about it, I'm sorry.
Why not?
Don't worry, I'll tell you later.
Rachel makes her way to what she thinks is a golden opportunity.
She was a sensible, grown-up 15-year-old. Her parents allowed her to travel on train. They trusted her to be responsible, to be sensible. And in turn, she was exactly that sort of person.
But Caroline's house is the most dangerous place Rachel can be.
Went back to the apartment. We know that Caroline bought some food, some pizza. A friend, a trusted person, an older person, inviting her to something fairly innocuous.
Caroline methodically follows her plan.
Caroline strangled Rachel with a cord. Using her own hands. It takes approximately 4 minutes for a strong person to kill someone by strangulation. That's how long Caroline tightened the cord on Rachel's neck.
Caroline wants to be born again as the new Rachel. But it's a plan that was never going to work.
The most shocking part of the crime surrounds its utter futility. The notion that she could assume a new identity after carrying out such a murder is ludicrous.
There was no way that Caroline was ever going to look like Rachel.
By removing the life force from Rachel, Caroline can't keep it for herself. It's gone.
There's obviously some little glitch in Caroline's mind that just didn't think logic of it through to its natural ending.
The only transformation is that Caroline is now a killer.
Caroline bundled her body into a wardrobe, still with the cable around her neck, and left her there for 2 days. At some time, Caroline wrapped Rachel's body in some blankets from her own flat, bundled them into a vehicle, and drove them to her father's property, where she buried Rachel in a shallow grave.
But her secret doesn't last very long. Caroline is the last person seen with Rachel and is top of the police's interview list. She is surprisingly frank.
Caroline admitted to what she had done and told police where she had buried the body.
Caroline Reed Robertson is convicted of murder on November 29th, 2000.
She received a sentence of 20 years in jail. The judge ordered that she serve a minimum of 14 and a half years before being eligible to be considered for parole.
With time already spent in custody, Caroline is up for parole in late 2013. Some believe the murder was an act of insanity, but the court doesn't agree.
Well, the plea of guilty is an acknowledgement of not only the act of killing, but it's also that you possess the necessary mental element, that is, an intention to kill.
For others, it was a simple human failing.
Some psychiatrists would look at this murder and say that Caroline was overwhelmed by a deep-seated need to shed her own skin and become someone else. I say she was motivated out of jealousy, pure and simple.
In prison, Caroline gets another life, but nothing like the one she so desperately admired. Rachel is gone forever, taken from her devastated family.
The whole event just seems so pointless and sad from everybody's perspective. Rachel is dead. Caroline's life has been ruined. One doesn't know what the future will hold for her when and if she comes out of jail. It's just an all-round tragedy.
These deadly women brutally stole lives for their own satisfaction. Ruby Thomas fostered a love of hate and killed a stranger. Julia Diaz stole an innocent life for greed. And Caroline Reed Robertson thought murder would make her a new person. Their hatred destroyed innocent lives because they were heartless souls.